Is Science a Way of Knowing? The fourth talk at Gutenberg College's 2012 Summer Institute, What the Bleep Can We Know?, was presented by Chris Swanson on July 14, 2012. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Go ahead and start. The conference has been what can we know and how can we know through various disciplines is sort of the approach that we're taking. And this morning we're going to talk about how we can know or whether we can know or what can we know through science. We spent a lot of time talking about this in Gutenberg College, and there are lots of different issues to talk about with regard to this question, and I am going to wholesale ignore a large number of those issues just because there's a limited amount of time that we can talk about. So things like induction versus deduction or rationalism and empiricism and proof and those sorts of things like that, I'm not really going to spend a lot of time talking about that. The thing that I'm going to spend most of my time talking about is sort of the problem of paradigms, and also address the kinds of questions that Casey was addressing at the beginning about the certainty of science. Is science certain? Is science more certain than other kinds of knowledge? Is it authoritative? Should it be authoritative? Is it more authoritative than other kinds of science, the other kinds of disciplines? And then also, is it somehow fundamentally different in the way that we come to know in science than the way that we come to know in other areas? So I think that talking about the problem of paradigms that Kuhn has raised in the discussion that we just had is a good way of talking about those issues. The way I'm going to start to get into that, I think, is I want to present the way I think about epistemology, how we come to know things. How is it that we form ideas? So when we read in Dorothy Sayers, she talked at one point about the idea of a tree. We have individual examples of trees. And from those individual examples, we will create this concept of tree, which all the other trees that we have examined fit under. And I think that's a really good way of thinking about how we come up with a lot of concepts. But I'm not sure that that's the only way that we come up with concepts. I think a lot of concepts and a lot of ways that we come to know things is through analogies and models that we build. I think Tim gave an example of the kind of model that we build yesterday when he was talking about being at the Kiva when somebody came up and asked him the question, so-and-so is going to call you back. I don't even remember the name. And he created for himself a narrative, which I think is also a kind of a model. It's a way of explaining a wide variety of phenomenon. And a lot of times we can come up with a model through analogy. We look at something and we say, that thing over there is kind of like this thing over here. So I'm going to give you an example of a scientific model that I think is really interesting. It is by created by Descartes, since we've been talking a little bit about Descartes. Descartes starts with a couple of assumptions. Prior to creating his model, he's going to make a model for the universe. And the assumptions that he comes up with, or that he starts with before he makes his model, is that there is a distinction to be made between the material world, on the one hand, and sort of the mind and spirit world, on the other hand. And with regard to the material world, okay, everything in the material world is mechanical. There's things that are pushing and shoving on each other and touching and feeling, and there's these things bumping into each other, sort of matter in motion kind of an idea. And that's all there is to it. So he takes these ideas, this assumption of mechanism, and assumption of the material world. And he says, how is it that we are going to understand the universe, the solar system, the planets, the sun, all that kind of stuff like that? And he is convinced at this time, because he is coming after the period of Copernicus, and he is coming after the period of Galileo, he's convinced that the sun is in the center of the solar system. And he sees all the planets swirling around the sun, and he realizes that the Earth is swirling around, the moon is swirling around the Earth. And he also has found out that there is this planet Jupiter, and it has these four moons. And these moons are also going around Jupiter. And then he realizes, he imagines to himself, what kind of situation have I seen like that? And he talks about this vortex that he has seen on a river. I don't know if you guys have all seen little vortices on river. If you have a river that's flowing along and the water goes past a stone and it creates this little swirl. And the thing that he thought was intriguing is that the swirl is going around, all the water is going around in a circle there. But that whole vortex itself is also following the path of the water itself. So he thought to himself, by analogy with the swirling water, perhaps the way to understand the rest of the universe is that there is this flow of material, of little itty-bitty miniature tiny particles. And all those miniature tiny particles are swirling around, and there's this big vortex that the Earth is in, and the moon is caught in that vortex. And it is swirling around the Earth because it is in this huge, you know, swirl of stuff. And the Earth is also caught in the vortex of the sun, and all these other planets are caught in the vortex of the sun. And in a vortex on the water which is closest to the center goes around fastest, and the water which is farthest away from the center goes around slowest. And, wow, you know, Mercury is closest, and it goes around faster, and Saturn, and it goes around slower because it's farther out. This is a good explanation, and it's mechanical, and it sort of fits with everything that I can think of. That must be it. Now, Descartes would probably say the reason why he came up with that is through a purely deductive method, starting with principles that were indubitable. But I think he used a model, a mental model, an analogy, and came up with that idea. Okay, so that's the kind of thing. It turns out that Newton came along later and showed that there's no way that that model can fit a variety of other data. But at the time, the model and the analogy and the paradigm that Descartes created was very successful. Okay? And I think that when we do these sorts of analogies, we imbue the new idea that we have created with new meaning. It's not exactly identical to the swirl in the water. It has a new meaning. It has a new set of connotations that are brought to it. And so we use the analogy, but we can bring in new meaning and create new ideas through the analogy. And then we have to ask ourselves, when we create that model, we have to ask ourselves whether or not we're going to believe that that is an accurate model of what's actually going on. And I think one of the biggest criteria that we use when we're coming to know things is a word that I'm going to call fittedness. And what I mean by fittedness is that all the phenomena that we are experiencing sort of fit with the model. That the data of our experience fits with the model. Our internal sense of order and beauty is fitted with the model. I think anybody who's done a crossword puzzle. How many people have done a crossword puzzle? Hopefully most of you have done a crossword puzzle. No, it doesn't have to be the whole thing. It is highly satisfying for those of you who have done the whole thing to get it. And you know when you're starting to get it right that you got it right, because there's no way that it could go together in any other way. Sometimes you're sitting there and you're going, is this the right word? And you're going, You make a guess, and you think maybe this is the right word. And then as you're going along, there's a couple other clues that are going the other direction, and you're going, I just can't come up with any word that could possibly fit in that particular slot. And then you're stuck for a while, and then all of a sudden you go, oh, maybe this word that I have in there is the wrong one, and you replace a new word. And then all of a sudden, oh, all these other clues now are starting to make sense. And things just sort of fall together, and when you get the crossword puzzle, you go, and you know you got it, right? Because everything fits together. There's no way it could not be that way. I think that sense is a huge part of how we decide whether or not the model that we have created is a good model or whether it's a bad model. So my idea of how we form ideas, at least partially, is that we come up with these models, we come up with these concepts, we come up with these ideas that fit together a large group of phenomenon, and it also agrees with our sense of how things should be, the order and beauty that we're looking for from an intellectual perspective. Okay, so the next topic is presuppositions and paradigms, okay? So paradigms are a set of beliefs, a way of looking at things, a set of lenses through which we interpret our experience. It can be a model that incorporates a wide range of experiences. I think a paradigm can be used on a small scale, or it can be used on a much broader scale. It can be used in science. It can be used in other things besides science. I think Descartes' vortices is a paradigm for how the universe works. But we could also have paradigms having to do with non-scientific things. We might have a paradigm for how we should read the Bible. We might have a paradigm for politics. We might have a epistemological paradigm, how we come to know things, which is what I'm trying to explain to you right now, my paradigm for how you come to know things. So there's a variety of different ways that we could come up with paradigms. And I think that Kuhn is onto something when he realizes that the way that we are often operate is within a particular paradigm. We have a model, however we have gotten it, and we're constantly taking in information and comparing it with that model and making it fit in that model and in fact, we're often using that model to interpret the experiences that we have. That paradigm is being used to interpret the experiences that we are constantly getting. One problem, or at least one problem that scientists have often thought is a problem, is that you can't not have paradigms. It's not the case that you can take in experience and have absolutely no background, no sort of model upon which to interpret that data. It seems like we're constructed in such a way that there is no way that we cannot organize the world that comes at us into these paradigms. And so to the extent that we have them, they are going to affect how we look at the world. The big problem then is what if the paradigm is wrong? And how do we know that the paradigm is right? And that's sort of the question that Kuhn is raising in the reading that we were doing. Another issue to think about with regard to paradigms is that a lot of time the paradigms that we have are tacit. They're not explicit. We're not necessarily aware of the fact that we have this model in which we take in information. It's so part of us that we can't even necessarily articulate it clearly. That's not necessarily a bad thing. That's the way it is. That's the way it always is, and it always will be. And there's a sense in which that's okay. If it ain't broke, don't fix it, kind of an idea. However, there is some value in continuously being aware of one's paradigm and being able to evaluate it on an ongoing basis, especially if something comes up, like Kuhn talks, if you have an anomaly that occurs in your scientific thinking or in your experience and it doesn't fit in with your paradigm, it's worthwhile to be clear to articulate exactly what it is the paradigm is that you have so you can evaluate whether it's correct. Okay, so the next topic I want to talk about, I've talked about how we come up with ideas and I talked about the nature of paradigms a little bit. And the next section I want to talk about is skill. It seems to me that the process of coming to knowledge requires a certain amount of, a great deal of skill. So what do I mean by that? There are a variety of different intellectual skills and non-intellectual skills. So there might be athletic skills, There might be social skills. There might be intellectual skills. An athletic skill might be hitting a baseball with a bat being thrown at you at 90 miles an hour. That takes a certain amount of skill. A social skill might be interpreting nonverbal clues from people that are around you. An intellectual skill might be the ability to read a very difficult book. And we all have a variety of skills, and we develop those skills to become experts in these various things. And the skill can be developed through practice and also through natural aptitude. Some people just have a natural aptitude for hitting a baseball. I don't happen to have natural aptitude for hitting a baseball, but some people do. But just because you have a natural aptitude for hitting a baseball doesn't mean you're going to automatically be a great baseball player. You also have to practice. In the process of using these these skills, we need to develop the use of tools in these skills. All right. So, what is a tool? So, for instance, with regard to hitting a baseball, the tool that I would refer to in this situation would be the baseball bat. Okay. We have to develop a familiarity with the baseball bat and have used it a long time in order to use it as a tool to hit the baseball. A tool perhaps in our social skill of interpreting people's nonverbal clues would be looking in their eyes. Maybe some people are able to always use that tool of looking in people's eyes to figure out some of their nonverbal skills and how they're thinking and how they're feeling or something like that. Or an intellectual tool might be learning grammar. Okay, so if you are expert in grammar and understanding and pulling apart sentences and understanding them, then reading difficult works and interpreting them well is a skill that you will have using the tool of grammar. Okay? And I think scientists, when they are doing science and they are learning things, they spend a huge amount of time developing those tools in order to have skill at knowing things in science. So the kinds of tools that they might learn in science would be things like mathematics. Creating analogies might be a tool that they might develop. Experiments, creating and conducting experiments would be a tool. Or using certain kinds of equipment might be a tool. You can use the equipment to do an experiment. The process of induction is a kind of a tool that one might use. Deduction. Also, another tool that scientists will use is dialogue and interaction with other scientists. And then lastly, I think, although they wouldn't necessarily describe this as a tool, I think a lot of scientists use this idea of fittedness as a tool. Sometimes they'll be very explicit and they'll be self-conscious about the fact that they think that this particular theory is right because it just... everything falls into line. And I think that there is a development of that tool that scientists develop for themselves. They work on being able to recognize whether or not everything is fitting or whether everything is not fitting, whether everything is coming together or whether there's something that's just sort of this grain of sand or this pea underneath the mattress that is just not right. And if it's not right, they are worried about whether or not the model that they have created is correct or not. And I think that there is some development where they create expertise for themselves in recognizing whether or not things are fitting or not. With all these tools, and this is a lot of this I'm getting from Michael Polanyi, he recognizes that in the use of tools, the tool itself goes out of focus. Okay, what do I mean by that? He gives this great example of a blind person who walks and he uses a walking stick. Okay? The person who is walking with a walking stick, the blind man that's walking around, and he's got this thing and he's waving it out in front of him, he's not thinking about the walking stick. The walking stick is truly a tool, and he is using this tool to determine what's going on in front of him. What he's concerned about, what he's focusing on, is that space in front of him and what's in that space in front of him. He's not focusing on the vibrations that he might get from that particular walking stick. The same thing happens with the baseball player with the baseball bat. He's not focusing on the baseball bat. To focus on the baseball bat would be foolish. He's focusing on what he's going to do with the bat. He's focusing on where the ball is. He's not thinking so much about his swing. If he has to think about his swing, that's what he did when he was a kid or when he was training or when he's doing batting practice or something. He's thinking about exactly where his arms are and where the bat is and whether it's going high or low. When he's batting, he's thinking about that ball and whether he's going to hit it, right? And the same thing happens in all of our other kinds of tools. I'm really familiar with soccer. When I'm playing soccer, I'm not thinking about my technique of how I hold my foot or how my foot is connecting with the ball. I'm constantly thinking about that guy over there who's supposed to receive the ball and whether or not I can get it to him, right? I'm not thinking about exactly how I'm kicking it. So the focus that we have when we're using these tools is usually not on the tools themselves. The tools themselves sort of become tacitly part of our equipment that we use to figure out what's true and to know things and to accomplish things and that sort of thing. And I think to some extent, a paradigm operates in the same way, all right? When a scientist is doing normal science, when a scientist is doing most of their research, that paradigm that they are using is something which is in the background. It is something that they are assuming to be true, something which is a tool. Then they are not focusing on whether it's true or anything about it. They are focusing on the experiment or the theory or whatever it is that they're working on, assuming that paradigm. It's sort of tacit as part of their intellectual grab bag of things that they can use to figure out what's true. So I think that tools, the paradigm is in some sense kind of a tool that is being used in order to figure out what's true and what's not true. Okay, so I've talked about how we come up with ideas using models, and I've talked a little bit about paradigms and how they sort of are incorporated in the way we think about things, and I've talked about how skill is necessary in order to come to know. The next topic is will, all right? So it seems to me that coming to know incorporates not only skills and paradigms and making analogies and things like that, but it also incorporates our will. If I want to believe something, it is easy to believe it. And if I do not want to believe something, it is hard to believe it. Okay? So our will usually plays a role. If a scientist has a theory and if they can come up with an experiment that proves the theory, they are going to get a grant and a promotion and a prize, then they are predisposed to want that this experiment is going to reveal what they want it to reveal. And they are going to work very hard on making sure that the data actually, you know, agrees with the theory that they have. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's a foregone conclusion that they're going to find the answer that they want. But I'm just saying that it has an impact on the way that they think about things. And I think that will, and I think one of the reasons why, well, I'll come to this later, but will does play a role in scientific work as well as in other areas. I think in some cases will plays less of a role, but it's not completely eradicated from the scientific endeavor. We have pride in our ideas as scientists. All scientists have pride. We have career advancement that scientists are thinking about. They think about money. Sometimes there's monetary reward associated with scientific endeavor. Sometimes there's political ideology associated with scientific endeavor, or even religious ideology. I mean, obviously, the whole debate between naturalism, evolutionistic naturalism versus theism, is a debate in which it's a scientific debate in which religious ideology plays a big role, and what we want and what we believe and what we will has an impact on how we're going to interpret that information. I think one of the main streams in the last in the modern age, the last 400 year or 500 years, has been in science, has been to try and completely eradicate will from the picture. We want to make science a perfectly objective. No subjectivity is involved whatsoever in our scientific endeavor. And to the extent that we can make it perfectly objective and separate it completely away from the scientific bias or anything like that, then it's good science. And if we cannot separate it out, then it's not necessarily good. So there has been this movement to try and make that separation. But what I'm suggesting to you is that that's not something which is possible, that that's not the way it works. So when we are coming to know, whether it be in science or in other areas, it seems to me that one of the requirements is that we be honest, that we be good judges, and that we be honest with ourselves especially. And that's sometimes very difficult, especially if we hold or cherish certain beliefs very strongly. So the conclusion is that will plays an important role in the way that we know things. All right, so all that stuff is sort of preliminary. Now what I want to talk about is judging paradigms. How do you go about the process of judging whether a paradigm is true? All right, Kuhn claims, I think, that you can't really judge if a paradigm is correct using science and logic and purely rational means, and that ultimately there is no way of deciding between competing paradigms. If you have two different groups that seem to be able to account for the information that is in front of them, that they are going to interpret it from their particular perspective and make sense of all the phenomenon, and these group is going to make sense of all their phenomenon, and there's no scientific way of determining which of these two is exactly the correct paradigm, and that the way that the paradigms are chosen is sort of extra scientific in some sense, having to do with persuasion. I think that with regard to that issue, that there's a sense in which he's right to recognize the importance that paradigms plays in the way we think about what's true and what's not true, that presuppositions and paradigms have a huge role. I think he's right that people from different paradigms often will talk past each other and have different kinds of languages as well, different kinds of ways of expressing things, different ideas in order to talk about things. And that I think he's right in recognizing that what a revolution is, if you want to call it a revolution, is when a paradigm is changing. And that's, I think, a good insight, that you've got this large model, like Descartes' model of vortices, and when that whole structure falls apart, you've completely replaced the paradigm, and he's calling that a revolution. I think that's a reasonable insight. But I don't think that paradigms cannot be judged or that they are as incompatible as he seems to claim. I think that even when you have a revolution, there are things that are not overthrown, that there are parts of older paradigms that continue on into the new paradigm. He seems to claim that the things from the old paradigm are completely overthrown and there's absolutely nothing from the old paradigm that is carried over into the new paradigm. But I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think that an example from astronomy will maybe make that clear, because I think the example from astronomy is the one that he points to as saying this is where you have this radical change in your paradigms. He often talks about this particular situation, that there's no way of talking between the paradigms. But I think that there's something that's being kept. Like, for instance, in the ancient view, the ancient Greek view, okay, they had the belief that there was the Earth in the center of the solar system and that all the planets and the sun went around. And when Copernicus comes along, there is this radical change of putting the sun in the center of the solar system and the Earth being a planet now. And it is true that now the Earth is a planet. The other planets are hunks of rock as opposed to celestial, ethereal items which maybe have souls and intelligences and stuff like that. Okay, so there's this huge change in the way they're thinking about them. But there is something which is kept. What the Greeks did, what was their lasting contribution, was the idea that mathematics, and order were in control of the behavior of the planets and the sun and the solar system. And that particular idea, that notion of how to understand things, has stood the test of time. Astronomers still believe that. And we will continue to believe that, that you can use mathematical order to understand what's going on. And that insight that the Greeks had at that time, over and against the prior view, which was that it was all chaotic and that it was controlled by the whims of gods and that sort of thing, the idea that there was order was a lasting contribution. Then Copernicus comes along, and his paradigm is in some sense replaced by Kepler. Okay, Copernicus has this idea that the sun is in the center and that the planets are going around in perfect circles. That's part of the way that Copernicus is describing things. But in order to account for the actual phenomenon, you can't just have the Earth going in a circle around the sun. You have to have a big circle that's going around the sun, and then a smaller circle, which is on top of the bigger circle, which is going around swirling like this in some way, this epicycle. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of that idea, of an epicycle on a larger circular motion. Okay, so Copernicus believed because things had to go in perfect circles, that was the necessary phenomenon. And Kepler comes along and says, well, I tried to make it fit, and I tried to make it fit, and I tried to make it fit, and I couldn't make it fit. So I think actually planets go on elliptical paths. Okay, that was a major change. Perfect circles have been replaced with elliptical paths. But what has been kept? The sun is still in the center. Kepler has not gotten rid of that. There's still mathematics that is being used to describe what's going on. There is a continuity there. When we come along with Newton, all right, he wants to... Oh, so what is it that's lost when... Okay, when Newton comes along, he's got a universal theory of gravity to explain why things are going on in elliptical orbits, okay? It is true that when Newton comes along and explains this using the theory of gravity, some of the aspects of Kepler's paradigm are lost, because Kepler, we don't learn about this in school, but Kepler was sort of toying with the idea that these planets that were going in elliptical orbits, how did they go in elliptical orbits? Perhaps they had intelligences or souls inside them that caused them to go in this order, in this orderly pattern. Or the other idea that he had was that it was a physical cause, but that the physical cause was sort of magnetic, that the sun was this gigantic magnet that was attracting the planets. Okay, Newton comes along and replaces that, it's true, but he keeps Keplerian elliptical orbits. And Newton comes along and says that there's this theory of gravity, and Newton's ideas are in some sense replaced by Einstein. Einstein did not believe in action at a distance, but the idea of any two material structures having an attraction between them, maybe the reason why there's an attraction between them has changed, or the nature of that attraction has changed, but the fact that there is universal gravitation between any two massive objects is something that has remained. So it seems to me that in that long history where everybody points to and says, oh, there's these massive revolutions and all these astronomical theories, there's also a lot of stuff that remains and is kept. There are true aspects of these theories that continue on. And so it seems to me that although there are revolutions in some sense, there's some continuity as well. I also think that even incompatible paradigms can be judged. I think that they can be evaluated using intellectual tools, and maybe they are being evaluated by using intellectual tools that are outside of the particular paradigm, but I think that the intellectual tools that we use to judge paradigms are just as valid as the intellectual tools that we use within the paradigms. We may use statistics, or we may use, some inductive step within our particular paradigm or our particular mathematical thing within our paradigm. But outside the paradigm, or judging between the two paradigms, we are still using intellectual tools such as fittedness, which everybody is going to be using in one sense or another when they're judging paradigms. Do all the pieces of data fit together in the most coherent and the most intellectually pleasing, the most satisfying way, okay? And I think Copernicus in particular, we can point to Copernicus to see that that was the criterion, that was the main criterion by which he claimed that the Earth is actually going around the sun. His data and Ptolemy's, his theory and Ptolemy's theory both equivalently accounted for the actual measurements that you could make of where the planets and the stars and the sun and all that kind of stuff was. But he thought that there was this coherence, this orderliness, this beauty, this fittedness that worked in his theory that was better than what was available for Ptolemy. And so on that basis, he was claiming that his paradigm is to be chosen over that of Ptolemy. And I think that the reason why he, the rest of the community eventually went over to his side is they recognize that that's an important criteria for judging, that things have to fit together. And they did fit together better with Copernicus. And that was why it was chosen. And so I think that using those intellectual tools, we can make progress and choose one paradigm as being right over another paradigm. Okay, so in conclusion, with regard to the problem of paradigms, I think that we can determine whether a paradigm is true, that it takes skill and effort. It requires the formation of some sort of a model when you're making the new paradigm. We use that model to interpret all the experiences, and we develop intellectual tools to test our paradigm for fittedness. Okay, so the last subject matter has to do with certainty in science. Casey mentioned at the very beginning of the conference that the authority for our culture has been, for the last 300 or 400 years, more associated with science than with, I forget exactly, with theology or philosophy. And so the question is, to what extent is science an authority more than, say, these other ways of thinking about things? It seems to me that the outline that I've given to you for how we come to know things is applicable beyond just science. I think that that's the way we come to know things in all other areas. If you are trying to know why this person asked me or told me that so-and-so called in Tim's narrative the other day, you're going to be creating a narrative, a paradigm, and you're going to ask whether or not all the information fits, whether it all comes together, whether it explains things. We're going to do tests like he described in his example that he gave the other day. And it seems to me that that's exactly the same phenomena that goes on in science. It's the same phenomena that goes on when we're reading a very difficult work. We look at all the words and we're trying to figure out, well, did this person mean this or did they mean this? And you come up with a theory saying, I think what they're trying to say is such and such. And then somebody else comes up with a theory, well, I think maybe they're saying such and such. And then you go back and you look at the text and you say, do those words fit better with this theory paradigm or with this way of interpretation? And by sorting those issues out, it seems to me that particular process is the same in science as it is in other areas. It seems to me that science does not have some sort of special, exalted status, that we don't completely get rid of the problems that are associated with other ways of thinking, that somehow science is not going to be true and certain in the way that sometimes it is portrayed by the culture. On the other hand, one of the reasons why science does have its authoritative status is that it seems to have been successful. So it might be worthwhile just to look a little bit, at least in my opinion, as to why maybe it has seemed to have been so successful. I think one of the reasons why it seems to have been so successful is that the questions that it has asked are not are not as hard. I'm not saying that they're not hard. They're just not as hard as some of the other questions that we ask about things. There are lots of questions that are very, very difficult to answer. We were writing down a bunch of questions at the beginning. I think those are very difficult questions to answer. And some of the scientific questions are a little bit easier than that. So there's been some success in answering them. Another reason why I think that scientists have been successful is that that they can go out and do a lot more testing. If they have a question, they can go and take more data and do more experiments and find out whether or not the model or the theory that they've put together is a correct model or theory, or whether it's a wrong model or theory. So they're constantly asking, here we've got this theory, let's go do an experiment to test it. Or somebody else is coming up with with an experiment, and they're finding out whether or not the model or the theory is correct. So, and because you have that opportunity to go out and do more experiments and more testing, you can gather more data and you can check the fittedness and whether or not that model actually corresponds to reality or not. That seems to me, and that has been somewhat helpful in trying to determine whether or not a theory is true. I think, just sort of as an aside, some of the modern high-energy cosmological theories that we often read about in the news or in the scientific, popular scientific, those are a little tricky because the opportunity for experiments on other stars is somewhat limited. So the ability to actually determine whether or not these theories are true, it would be really cool, they think, if they could replicate the Big Bang experiment. And then they could do a lot of tests. Unfortunately, nobody's figured out how to do that. And then the last thing I think that, and I alluded to this earlier, is that in some situations, will is of less significance in some of the scientific endeavors. I'm not saying it's not there. It is there, and it does play a role. But it is not as significant, I think, when it comes to religious aspects and religious questions and philosophical questions and philosophical debates, the aspect of the will becomes more significant and more important and plays a bigger role in what we will and will not believe. In the end, I think that science doesn't have any qualitative difference between the other fields of knowledge, and but that it has had some success due to these reasons. So that's all I have to say. So I'll take questions. Charlie's going to come up and help me answer questions if you guys have questions with regard to what I've said or with regard to the Kuhn reading or anything like that.
Kuhn makes reference to metaphysical speculation that sometimes scientists lean over into. And that brought to mind books like The Tao of Physics and The Dancing Woolly Masters and that kind of thing. And that was something I've always, especially when I was younger, had problems with, because I thought I could see that science was very influential and successful. And when I was trying to figure out how things worked, and I'd read about these scientific conclusions, and then at some point I'd have this sense that maybe they were straying over into metaphysical speculation and outside of science, but I couldn't tell for sure. And but people, they were using their scientific chops to defend their metaphysical speculations, and I didn't know how to push back for that. I was just wondering if you could talk about how we can tell when someone is moving from science, real scientific, valid exploration of knowledge and conclusions and that kind of thing, into metaphysical speculation.
I'll take a shot at it first here. My first comment would be, we have what I would call the received or traditional view of science, that what science is largely a method that tests hypotheses, and it's objective and it gives us certainty, unlike other fields of endeavor. Kuhn is challenging that, and I think rightly, that view of science isn't correct. So for the last 500 years, science has actually been presenting itself primarily as a method that's objective and certain, that doesn't do metaphysics, and that doesn't have any metaphysical assumptions. I think that's fallacious. That's never been a defensible position. So on one level, I want to answer that a view that would deny that science does metaphysics and ought to be involved in metaphysics, that a view that would propose that there's a science without metaphysics is not defensible. It's not true. So immediately we run into a question now of, well, where is the line then between a legitimate use of metaphysics and physics, or a legitimate use of science with metaphysics and not? That's a very difficult question, that question has also been going on for at least 500 years, and it's very difficult to sort out. So, for example, science for a long time has had a very difficult time deciding where the line is between science and things like astrology, magic. I mean, how exactly do we draw the line between what's legitimate science and what's not? It's a very difficult thing to answer. Why do we have the answer we currently have? There's astronomy and astrology, and never the two come together. Why do we believe that? And the answer is the Royal Society took a vote, and by a majority of three individuals, they determined what's science, what's astronomy, and what's astrology. Well, it's very difficult. So I would say, any view that would claim that science doesn't have any metaphysics, speculative or otherwise, is a fallacious view to start with. Secondly, then, the question of whether the metaphysics they're talking about is speculative or not, that's a very difficult philosophical question that, I mean, I can't answer that easily now. I don't know if anybody else wants to interject anything into that.
So, Chris, you said, so science doesn't have any special place, anything inherent in it that makes it a better way to know truth than other endeavors. And because of that, it shouldn't be, there's no, the level of certainty with it isn't what maybe it's purported to be. Could it be that we grant science a level of certainty because, as you said, there are tools that people use. They gain skills by practicing using those tools. Scientists are the most practiced at using their tools than anyone else, and therefore we give them a higher level of authority than other endeavors? Or am I just thinking about that wrong? Do scientists use their tools more often than anyone else, and therefore their tools are sharper than anyone else's?
Well, I don't know about anyone else's. I think scientists do spend a huge amount of time and effort sharpening and working on those tools. They work on certain kinds of tools, and sometimes they neglect other tools. For instance, scientists are abysmal readers. I know that from personal experience. Having gone through a graduate program in physics, I graduated and couldn't read. So those are the kinds of tools that they don't necessarily develop, but they do develop those scientific tools and they do spend a lot of time on them. I would say that they spend more time developing their tools than most average people, but there are a lot of people that spend a lot of time developing other kinds of tools. Theologians spend a huge amount of time developing logical reading tools and those sorts of tools that are really important in figuring out theological and spiritual and philosophical questions, that scientists don't develop those tools. So it's not clear to me that scientists somehow are better at using their tools than theologians are at using their tools. So I'm not sure if I'm addressing your question or not, but I mean,
no, I think that does. I mean, that addresses part of it.
Well, my take is I'm not so sure that scientists are any better at using their tools than anybody else. I mean, I think a good historian, a good philosopher, I mean, they're using their tools just as skillfully. It seems to me the fundamental difference between science and some of the other endeavors is actually the subject matter you're looking at. I mean, it's one thing to talk about balls, planets, and suns going around each other. It's another thing to talk about how individual people are going to vote or how they're going to decide. I mean, it's a very different thing to examine a solar system or examine a political system. The issue between the two isn't so much the use of tools, it's the complexity of what you're looking at. And human beings are way more complex than just these atoms and planets going around each other. So it seems to me the fundamental difference is that. It's the nature of the stuff we're looking at that's more important in how sure we can be about something or confident we can be about something than about the actual use and skill involved in coming to that knowledge.
Yeah, the questions are more difficult.
Yeah.
And is there not a particular reason for that in that some phenomenon, I mean, even if one agrees with me that all of reality is ultimately a narrative, some aspects of the narrative are law-like in their functioning. So that astronomy and physical sciences are law-like. Well, it's a lot easier to come to knowledge of law-like phenomenon than that's what you're calling the complexity.
I'm not sure exactly how to fit this into the flow of the narrative that's going on right now, but I think an important part of coming to knowledge is knowing that when you've reached a new conclusion, that it may not be the final answer, that there needs to be a degree of humility, a willingness to turn loose of your net that is covering the phenomenon that you're attempting to explain, and be willing to reach for a new handhold. I think Jack Crabtree exemplifies that better than anybody I've ever met in how he does theology and the whole study center. I brag on this place because of that. The willingness to acknowledge I could be wrong. There may be better answers out there. And if there are, that's what I want. I don't want to prove that I'm right where I'm standing. I don't want to turn my set screws down on my most recently arrived at conclusion and defend it. I want to leave those set screws finger tight so I can move when other information comes along that would improve rather than be stuck.
I completely agree with you. I would say I did not explore extensively the nature of how will plays a part into our knowing, but I think that is an excellent example of how our will plays into our knowing and the importance of it.
And just a comment I would want to make is that it seems that especially for scientists, they want to devise a method that's objective, that somehow takes judgment out of it. Because if you can take judgment out of it, that's how we get certainty. And it seems to me that's the fundamental error in most of the pursuit of science or defining science as a method. And so it seems to me that the notion of, one, our finiteness, that we're limited, there's only so much we can do, and two, that we're making judgments. And some judgments we have more grounds for than other judgments, but there's a sliding scale about, and that's a skill we must learn. And it seems to me as a culture, to the extent that we aim at finding these objective tests, these objective measures, these methods to quantify and replace human judgment, to the extent that we as a culture participate in those kinds of things, we're eroding our capacity to recognize and develop the skills of what it takes to really know.
Charlie, I remember when you were doing one of your PhDs and you were dealing with professors who were over you quarreling with your conclusions, and it was pretty clear that their quarrel had nothing to do with science and everything to do with all sorts of other things, such as, I wrote a book about this and you're saying the opposite and you couldn't possibly be right because then my book would be wrong and that's unacceptable. which is certainly not a scientific conclusion. And at the time, and then you went on, if I believe, to get another degree in philosophy of science. And it occurred to me how interesting, how backwards that seemed to me. Not that you were doing it backwards, but that science does it backwards. If you're going to do science, you'd think you learn about the philosophy of science, how you do science first. You'd think about what's the right way to do what I propose to do, and then you would do it, rather than do something and then maybe never even think about how did I do, or how do I think about what I was doing. And the same thing for politics. You've got, I'm sure you could think of it in terms of a philosophy of politics, a philosophy of government, a philosophy of computer programming. If I'm going to engage in a particular endeavor, I need to, before I try to do that, ideally, I need to think about how am I going to do that? What are my options? What are the preferred ways to do this as opposed to not preferred, and why? And we don't think about that. So I was wondering if you could, it seems like overarching all, ideally, we'd all study things that were relevant to all fields of endeavor, such as how do we know what we know, and what does goodness mean, and where do values come from, and all that kind of thing. And I was wondering if you would speculate for me or opine on what do you think are the fundamental tools that everybody needs to have, irrespective of their field of endeavor, in order to pursue their fields of endeavor? Does that make sense?
It makes sense. I doubt I could come close to answering that question. But what I would want to say is I think in part and parcel, that's what Gutenberg is in part about. I mean, in my own case, I sort of knew what I wanted to be when I grew up when I was young. And so for me, I just focused. I began to specialize in elementary school because I knew I wanted to be a scientist. Well, specialization has its advantages. It does. There are things that are a benefit to specialize. I mean, it allows you to burrow deeper into something than you would otherwise. But the problem with it is, if everybody sort of specializes, all of a sudden you become a specialist. If you get down to it, finally you're a specialist of some little tiny thing that's absolutely irrelevant to anything. So we all end up specialists of some little piece that's really irrelevant. And it seems to me that because of that push for specialization and just because the division of labor works, we think that that's ultimately the best way and the most efficient way in the end to come to knowledge, to be able to come together and work at a political system and an economic system and make this all work. Well, it seems to me that there are just those basic skills of learning how to read, learning how to think, learning how to listen, learning how to critically evaluate arguments, that those are the sorts of basic skills that are absolutely fundamental. So one, skills involved in understanding and coming to the conclusions of what your own view is, to put together a view that makes sense of all of reality, and then secondly, to be able to listen to someone else's who's different, understand those differences, and then be able to learn how to dialogue about those differences. Those seem to me to be fundamental, that transcend. Those are the kind of skills, at least some of them, I think, that are fundamentally important. And as I say, the more you specialize, the more you're going to lose those. I don't know if that's getting at it or if somebody else wants to take a shot.
This is going to be a kind of convoluted question because it's not entirely clear in my head. But one of the things that struck me about this reading was the Kuhn reading was he talks about the politics and scientific revolution sort of analogously. And that sort of got me thinking about progress and the American government and things like that, and maybe it's a generational thing, but it comes very easily to me to be critical of the American government and the idea that we have somehow progressed and we're somehow the pinnacle of political development is easy for me to scoff at. I'm also a Colombian citizen, and I've been to Colombia a few times, and it seems like their political operations are pretty corrupt and pretty backwards. So as critical as I am of American politics and the system here, it seems to function a lot better than the Colombian system. So I've just been wondering, like, is that a similar way of understanding like scientific paradigms and systems? Are there some things? I guess really my question is about progress. What is scientific progress? What does that mean? Is it similar to politics, where it just somehow works better? You can get a visa to travel quicker and less with less hassle. Or are there things like ethical things that, like, fairness or equality and things like that? Does that make any sense?
Well, yeah, I think I understand your question. I'll start to give an answer, and then you tell me if I'm answering your question fully. Well, first I'll comment on Ancun, and it's unfortunate you only had one chapter to read. But I agree with the conclusions that Chris gave about his notion of paradigm. So what Kuhn is saying is one paradigm is replaced by another paradigm. But in Kuhn's view, is there a goal? And in the last chapter, he tells us that paradigms aren't aimed towards anything. It's like Darwinian evolution. And that's almost a direct quote. He says it is like Darwinian evolution. By that, he means that chronologically, one paradigm just replaces another. If that's what you mean by progress, then there is progress, according to Kuhn. But I take it from your question that's not what you mean by progress, that you actually mean something like getting better or getting closer to a goal. In Kuhn's view, there is no goal, so we can't be getting closer to a goal. So, but in my own view, that science does have an objective. It does have a telos. And its goal at the end of the day is to describe what is true. In other words, what beliefs do I have? What beliefs do I have that actually correspond to the way the world really is? And I believe that science, to some extent, can come to some conclusions about some of those things. There is some progress at times coming to those conclusions. I mean, we know more facts. So, and those facts are important. But also important is we need to develop the right theories. And developing the right theory is very, very challenging. So it could be in some cases that new theories that we have now that have replaced older theories, those theories, seems to me as I look at history and look back, I'm pretty convinced that some of the theories we hold now are going to be found to be false. So in that case, although we've gained factual information, we've actually taken a step backwards with regard to the theory of. So both those things are involved in making progress in science. So I think science can make progress. At times it has made some progress, but I would argue at times it's also regressed. So does that get at answering at least part of your question?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.